like to thank Bruce, actually. He covered a lot of the, sort of major issues, the major critiques, if you will, of abstinence only. And what I'm going to try to do is kind of go deep on a couple issues, particularly the informational, misinformational issues. And any paranoia that my slides won't load is purely circumstantial. Anyway, oh, they worked. Okay. Well, the three of us presenters today took a pledge that we would all show you at least one picture of one Surgeon General. So this is my favorite. Actually, there was a wonderful APHA article in the new issue of the American Journal of Public Health. And it's a little bio about Surgeon General Koop. He's the guy that was Surgeon General when I started. Proud to serve with him. And this is what he said, talking about the AIDS epidemic in the early years. It was clear that the only weapon we had against AIDS was education, education, and more education. And I think I don't have to convince this audience that, boy, that's still true. Okay, let me start out with a little quiz. This has been approved by an IRB in some jurisdiction, I'm sure. So I'm going to ask you how many of you support, and you can raise your hands, how many of you support education about abstinence? Okay, kids ought to know about that, right? Okay, how many of you support abstinence education? A few hands. How many of you support abstinence-only education? Is anybody out there? Okay, how many of you support abstinence-only until marriage education? That's a mouthful, isn't it? Okay, we keep going. How about condom and contraceptive misinformation education? Okay. Greg's having a little trouble with the yes-no part of the response thing here. How about condom and contraceptive misinformation education by people who flunked high school biology? So anyway, it's always good to start with a little humor, especially in the afternoon. But I put this up for two reasons, one of which is how we answer a question is how we frame the question. So some people may see all four of those, or seven, six, is the same issue. Some of them may see them as very different. But yeah, so that's really important. And the other piece, obviously, I'm going to talk about education today. Okay, so, and Bruce has framed this out really well, but just let me give you my take on it. I think over the last decade, abstinence promotion has emerged as the primary U.S. government strategy for dealing with adolescent sexuality. I'd love to be challenged on that, but I think it's pretty true. You know, clearly the government does many things. It's a complicated operation. It does family planning. It does STD prevention. But I would say our policymakers in Washington have been talking more about this than anything. By 2005, there were over 800 programs that had been funded, over $1.5 billion spent, and increasingly, I think you know this, professionals, parents, policymakers have been raising concern about this. In 2007, we saw the confusing coverage in the New York Times and probably your local papers of concerted efforts in the Congress to end the program and then to increase the funding. And it was really into January before we found out what was really going to happen. Increasingly, and I'll talk more about this later, we're seeing states refuse federal ab-only funding. And we're also seeing many states talking about something called medical accuracy in sex education. And I'll come back to both of those today. So there's lots of critiques, and I think, again, Bruce covered most of them. But the ones related to information, misinformation, are things like the failure to be medically accurate, or even the promotion of misinformation, promoting sexist and racist stereotypes, withholding information from youth, promoting a moral agenda, not a public health agenda. Although it's often described as a public health program and it's implemented by HHS, at least one of those H's is health. But, you know, and we'll come back to the sort of language that I think establishes that. Many of the programs are poorly designed, and so they lack program efficacy. The kinds of elements that you may put into your program seem to be missing. And finally, that they're insensitive or unresponsive to GLBTQ youth, or even sexually active kids, because If you come in and you're sexually active to an STD clinic or any other sort of government-funded operation, if it's ab only, you're just basically told not to have sex. Okay. I think it's also part of a broader problem of a struggle in the public sphere between science and politics and between data and ideology. And we've seen the sort of denigration of science, misuse of science, denial of science in a lot of areas. Global warming, stem cell research, the approval of emergency contraception by FDA, and even the new human papillomavirus vaccine. Okay, so today I want to cover two things. I want to look at this issue of medical accuracy and misinformation, but I'd also like to try to reframe the debate. And Amy, I think, is going to do an even better job of reframing the debate. But I think we need to think about how we, as public health people, respond to what many of us may agree is a bad idea or see as having limitations anyway. So how do we respond? And so that's where I'm going to start. And again, I think Amy will finish up with some more about that. Okay. So I would contend to you that in many ways, abstinence only is replacing comprehensive sexuality education in this country. And it's causing harm to other public health programs. So it's not a little add-on program where they, you know, a little boring lecture where the kids fall asleep because somebody's lecturing to them about not having sex, but it's causing fundamental changes to the way we do education. So what we've seen around the country is censorship of textbooks. In 2003, the state of Texas took out information from the textbooks on contraception and condoms. So kids no longer got that information, if you will. We see increasingly teachers in public schools don't know what they can say. Sometimes they feel like they can't say anything, but increasingly I think they often just don't know what they can say. And Bruce alluded to that very funny new novel, The Abstinence Teacher, and it's really about that struggle in a local community, and that's what we've been seeing around the country, the struggle in local communities about what can be taught in sex education. But, you know, those are anecdotal, if you will. I was trained as an epidemiologist, so I have to call them anecdotal. But we've got some good quantitative data that suggests that abstinence only is replacing comprehensive sex ed. So surveys, of paired surveys over time of teachers, superintendents, young people themselves, all suggest it. We've seen injection of requirements for abstinence or requirements for ABC increasingly going into things like the Title X program and even into CDC's HIV prevention programs. And Bruce alluded to the challenge to PEPFAR in the prevention set aside. So this is one data set. This is the National Survey of Family Growth collected by CDC, looking at teaching about birth control in 95 and 2002. You can see it clearly went down. These are young people who got formal education about that. You can see abstinence is higher, and it's stayed up there. Interestingly, on the far right, you see teaching about neither has also increased a little bit. I think my impression or my interpretation of this data is a lot of local schools are getting fed up with these constant culture battles and are saying, well, we just won't deal with that issue in the public schools. This is from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. This is HIV education, HIV AIDS education. And you can see it peaked in about 97, about 10 years after Surgeon General Koop's report, and then slowly begun to go down. And we'll have the new data this summer for 2007. And I actually was in Africa a couple weeks ago with President Bush. Actually, he was in a motorcade going by, and I was stuck in a taxi because you couldn't get anywhere in town in the capital that day. But it was very interesting. The only time he was in Africa, I think, for a week, the only time he was asked about AIDS was in Ghana. And they have a wonderful free press there. It's a great country to visit. I would suggest you all go. But was asked specifically about the one-third set-aside in the PEPFAR initiative. This is what Mr. Bush said. I monitor the results, and if it looks like it's not working, then we'll change. But thus far as I can report, at least to our citizens, that the program has been unbelievably effective, and we're going to stay at it. Again, we have a little informational flow problem up the chain of command. Okay, so let's talk about medical accuracy. So I think it's really become a critical element in current policy debates around abstinence policies, particularly at the state level. Some of it relates to just looking at the language in the curricula, in the programs, or in the federal requirements. It also entails analysis of kind of information in the curricula. And finally, there have been some very interesting efforts to use now medical accuracy as a way of fixing some of this problem. Okay, so the original report on this was from 2004, the Representative Waxman's committee. He was at that point in the minority staff. And he's going to have new hearings, I guess, in early April about this now that he's in the majority. But it pointed out that there were major errors and distortions of public health information in 11 of the 13 curricula that were commonly funded by HHS. They included false, misleading, or distorted information, lots of misinformation about the effectiveness of contraception, the risks of abortion. There were other scientific errors. One of the curriculum couldn't even get the number of chromosomes in the human body correct. So that's why I say that some of those guys didn't pass high school biology. And importantly, there was treating of stereotypes. So Ozzie and Harriet was treated as fact. There were actually two GAO reports. Bruce covered one, I'll cover the other, in the fall of 2006. One of which was the GAO said to HHS, yeah, actually you should enforce medical accuracy provisions. Well, the other one said you don't have any mechanisms for doing it. And so this is what GAO said, efforts by HHS and states to assess the scientific accuracy of materials used in ab-only programs has been limited, and that there's essentially no system in place for doing that. Okay, so now if you look at the language here, I think that's helpful, because I think it says something about what these are all about. So you frequently see the use of terms in the curriculum, in the federal requirements, for things, you know, words like chaste and virgin and promiscuous. Now, how many of you use the word promiscuous, you know, as you're counseling patients? Does anybody use that term? Do you even use the word virgin or chaste? I mean, is there a moral value to that? Yeah, I mean, we're all taught, I think, as clinicians, to use value-neutral language. But this program clearly goes against that. It frames abstinence as an attitude or a commitment, sort of a lifestyle choice, if you will. And again, it shows up in the ADH definition, a mutually faithful monogamous relationship in the context of marriage is the expected standard of human sexual activity. In case anybody had any questions of what the standards are around here, it's very well spelled out now by the Congress. Has anyone heard the expression, you know, abstinence is the only 100% effective way to prevent blah, 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 STDs, pregnancy? Repeated over and over and over again by the program sponsors. Does it always work? What's the problem with that statement? Is there sometimes a disconnect between intentions and behavior? That's what my friends in behavioral science tell me. But there's a real certainty about how efficacious it is. I think that's partly what we were hearing from President Bush when he went to Ghana. There's an assertion of medical facts, and Bruce did a nice job talking about how sex leads to crime. Okay. They really believe that early sex harms your chances for a successful marriage and really does lead to depression and suicide. They really do. That's repeated over and over and over again. Importantly, for you all, there's a denigration of condoms and contraception. There's a lot of fear messages, but there's also a lot of misinformation about them. So Bruce read one to you, and I'll show you a couple more. And I would suggest to you, even there's sort of a genesis story, a creation of a post-sex syndrome. I think many of you have heard of the post-abortion syndrome, which was again created by, you know, folks, social conservatives, who believe that abortion really causes major harm, despite whatever the scientific evidence. And I'm not sure that there really is a post-sex syndrome. It's certainly not in the DSM. Okay. So let me give you a couple analyses that we did. Actually, ACLU asked us to review this video by Pam Stenzel. These were some of the themes that came out of it. This was a group at Columbia. So there's incorrect information. You get a virus, you've got it for life, and there's no cure. So all viruses last forever? That's the implication. Well, many of them you actually do get rid of. Some you can't. Missing information. So there's no information about condom efficacy, about social skills, or about how to access care if you think you have STD symptoms. There's lots of inflammatory and vague sort of emotional language. So I love this one. Over 70 strains of HPV alone, the most cancerous strains don't produce warts at all. Not sure what that means. But anyway, all it takes is skin-to-skin contact anywhere in the genital area. You're infected for life and will infect everyone you have genital contact with after that. Okay. There's also language in there that suggests, I think, that their vision of adolescence is really from a parallel planet. If you end up having sex when you're young, that's all your relationship's going to be based on. Is that the only reason kids have sex? And when they have sex, do they sort of lose all inhibitions and go out of control? I mean, most of the adolescents I know, many of them are in relationships. So there's a sort of a denial of the relationship quality. Talked about moral language, and I'll leave the gender and racial stereotypes to another time. We did a recent analysis, again, for ACLU, looking at three of the commonly used curricula. And we found that they explicitly or implicitly convey the message that condoms fail to protect against STIs. They include references that are out of date or do not represent sort of current knowledge. They often misrepresent studies. So again, remember, they're supposed to talk about failure of condoms or failure rates, but they often take a study with, you know, 16 different failure rates, and they'll take the highest one and represent that as what they're talking about. They often fail to distinguish between so-called perfect use and typical use. So if you use a condom correctly and consistently, there's a 2% pregnancy rate per year. If you use it the way it's commonly used, it's probably closer to 17%. Okay. They incorrectly compare HIV transmission risk and pregnancy risk. Okay, so this is Speedy the sperm. Has anyone met Speedy? Now look at the logic here. Okay, so they have this little picture in the manual for the kids, and you can see those teeny little herpes particles and that very tiny little HIV particle. And you see that big monster as Speedy. Since the HIV virus is smaller than a sperm and you can and can infect you any day of the month, the failure rate of the condom to prevent AIDS is logically much worse than its failure rate to prevent pregnancy. Does that make any sense? I mean, it leaves out a whole lot of information. The calculation of pregnancies is number of pregnancies occurring in a year, the percent of women getting pregnant in a year, whereas HIV is usually per coital act or for, so anyway, or it's a percentage change. But there's this, because you end up with two percentages, people try to compare the two percentages. Here's another one, the truth about condoms. This was, actually, I picked this up at the American Public Health Association meetings a few months ago, the last annual meeting. It was a little ab-only booth that didn't describe itself as ab-only, so it snuck in. But these were some of the pamphlets they were passing out. Just using condoms is like playing Russian roulette. In chamber one, you have a condom that breaks and you get syphilis. In chamber two, you have an STD that condoms won't protect against at all. In chamber three, you have a routinely fatal disease. And in chamber four, you have a new STD that hasn't even been studied. Okay, so what's all that about? Starts with an F, Ends with an R. Okay. And I won't go through all of these. These were some more that I picked up. Actually, my kids really liked the one on oral sex on the right, because it was right after Halloween, and they thought that was great. But okay, I won't go through all these messages, because in the interest of time. So I think there's some underlying assumptions, one of which is that sex ed and access to contraception cause kids to have sex. The teaching about abstinence and protection is a mixed message. And describing the limitations of contraceptive methods will stop teenagers from having sex. Not a lot of evidence for any of those. Interesting, I think there's an inconsistency of ab-only education with basic scientific theory. There is, you'd have to say they have a sort of encompassing worldview that's sort of hermetically, you know, it's a paradigm, sort of like paradigms in science, but it's really an ideological belief system that's internally consistent, but not often logical or correct. There are many separate incorrect facts, and importantly, there's a refusal to follow scientific consensus or the rules of scientific review. And I've been through many versions of clearance at CDC, so I can tell you a lot about that. But anyway, so let's talk about reframing the debate on sexuality. The first of which is I think we need to talk about human rights. If you get into a debate about what works and what's right, I think you're going to lose. We need to say what we do is right. And part of the right is teens have a right to an education. They have a right to information that will protect them from getting STDs, unintended pregnancy, and HIV. They have a right. It's, you can look at it in international treaties, the Convention on the Child, for instance, talks about that. And importantly, those international documents talk about government's responsibility to provide accurate information in the course of their programs. Bruce talked a little bit about the refusals. We just finished one study on this. We now, you know, a little over a year ago, we had 4 states refusing, and now we have 17 states refusing. The most recent is Iowa, one of those real liberal states out there. We tried to figure out why states were doing this, so we did a series of case studies with some of my grad students. Then we looked at states that had refused early on. We looked at New Mexico, where Bruce is from, and they had an interesting approach. They said they will take the money, but we won't follow the rules. It's always a good idea. And then there were Texas and Indiana, which were pretty consistent that they were going to take it. We found some very interesting things. Again, medical accuracy and state education standards was often raised as a reason why states were refusing the money. Program evaluations, particularly local ones, was often used, or the Mathematica study. Interestingly, progressive politicians working with the advocates was critical in every state, I think, that's refused it. So get activated if you want to end this and work with your governor's office. This issue of medical accuracy is also increasingly appearing in state laws. So as of last spring, actually, we just rechecked it. 21 states now in this country require medical accuracy in the provision of sex ed or other sorts of health programs. And in 7 states, they've even gone as far as to define what that is. This, I think it's important for this group because you all are going to be the people that are going to get to sit on the bodies that make decisions about what's medically accurate. And this is a paper we've got coming out in American Journal of Public Health, and this is our definition, again, based on these state definitions, most of which are pretty good. Based on the weight of scientific evidence published in peer-reviewed journals, conducted under accepted scientific methods, consistent with generally recognized scientific theory, and recognized as objective, accurate, complete by mainstream professional organizations. And many of them mention CDC, I'm glad to hear. Many of them mention FDA or AMA or APHA. This is really important. Your mainstream organizations, all of which support, as Bruce described, support comprehensive sex ed, are the groups that states are going to turn to, and perhaps not some of the fringe medical organizations. So, okay. we need to get real about sex education. You know, there's this huge public support, and there have actually been some bills introduced in Congress, and your state has been introducing a number of bills at the congressional level. In Washington, we've got the REAL Act, the Responsible Education About Life. Now, these things don't get enacted the first time, but I think there's building support for it. You know, importantly, I think we need to think about how we can use the internet more smartly. And I mean, I know this group has actually done that, and I think CDC has supported that. Places like San Francisco and ISIS, we're speaking next door, have done this. But there's websites like Sex Etc. and Go Ask Alice in Columbia. There's lots of great informational sources, and somehow we've got to figure out, you know, among these, which are going to be really effective in doing this. So let me sum up by saying I think there's a need to return to science-based policies. Critically important in this is going to be political leadership. There is going to be new leadership. We don't know who it's going to be in the fall in the White House, and that's going to be critical. And finally, we need to think about how we promote healthy sexuality, and I'm going to turn that over to Amy to let her explain that to you. Thank you.